Guys, Roland here. In this conversation, we get to touch on multiple topics, near-death experiences, living a life without regret. Is that even possible? I don't know. But the guest I have has some insights I think is worth listening. You get to meet her right after this.
Welcome to Conversations with Roland, where the goal of this show is to learn life secrets through diverse experiences. I am your host, Roland Achenjang.
Guys, welcome to another episode of Conversations with Roland. As always, I am super excited to record these conversations, and today's no different. Today with me is an amazing person. When my guest was 12 years old, she had a rare brain malformation that needed emergency surgery. She had a near-death experience while in surgery. She has been paralyzed on her left side of the body since. Today, she's an author, speaker, a podcaster like myself, and a coach filled with a passion for her message of eliminating regret and also sharing lessons and experiences she learned as a result of her near-death experience. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome Kirsty Salisbury to Conversations with Roland. Kirsty, how are you?
Hi, I'm great, thank you. Thank you so much for that awesome intro. I'm really excited by our conversation today.
I am too. And with regards to the intro, you're absolutely welcome. I always find it funny trying to summarize someone's entire life in like 2 minutes. And I know I usually do them a disservice just because there's so much about your life experiences that's not included in there, you know?
Yeah, totally. That's just how it goes, isn't it? Because we've got a lifetime and yeah, like you say, a couple of minutes. I do just want to clarify one thing going forward is that you said I'd been paralyzed down my left side ever since. Mm-hmm. I've actually made nearly a full recovery. So yeah, we can get into that detail, but I just wanted to clarify that actually I'm pretty good right now. I'm not paralyzed. So
okay.
Good news, huh?
That's like, I was going to say a miracle, but yeah, that's amazing news. So let's start right there, right? Because I think this is really great talking about living life after an NDE and then going through this sort of full recovery. I say we jump right into that if you don't mind sharing this, because this is news to me too. So how did that happen?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's not quite a miracle, but in a way I go, oh, I definitely got some interesting help along the way. So going back to the beginning, I was 12 years old. I was a competitive gymnast, so very active. You could not keep me still. I would always bounce around the place. I was always moving. My parents talk about how I was always on the go and moving around the place. So I was at school one day and I actually hit my head on the bars. I was always in my lunch times trying to get some extra practice, and I was just so passionate about my sport. I loved it. And my lunch times, I would go out to the playground in school time. And this one day I hit my head on the bar, and it was a metal bar. And I didn't really think too much of it. It hurt, but it wasn't excruciating. I went back to school, back to class. I had a normal day. And then it was a couple of hours later, I guess like the next 48 hours, that I started to get a bit of fatigue. I started to feel tired and lethargic, and I thought maybe I was just coming down with something. I did not associate this to me hitting my head on the bar. And then in the evening, I went home and I was really tired. So I went to bed, I had an early night, and I thought probably I'd just been training too hard. I didn't really think that there was too much to it, until I woke up a couple of hours later, and it was quite late by this time. Everybody else had gone to bed, and I had this excruciating headache, and I knew that something was really, really wrong at that moment. So I had this headache. I didn't know what to do about it, but I remember being there and my body thinking, the pain is so different to anything I've ever felt. The pain is so specific. And I was almost okay with the pain. It's quite a hard one to explain. The pain meant that I didn't feel too well, so I got up out of bed. I tried to go off to the bathroom, and I collapsed on the floor. And it was at that point that I was thinking, something's really not right here because my body doesn't work properly. I couldn't stand back up off the floor and I was trying to get to the bathroom and yeah, my body just wasn't working. So in the end, I ended up making quite a bit of noise as I kept pulling. I remember pulling up on the bed leg, trying to get myself up into bed and crashing on the floor and then trying again. So I was making a racket. My mother came in and found me and was prepared to probably tell me off, what are you doing in the middle of the night making all this noise? Because that was kind of the behavior that I had at that stage because I was young and active. She wouldn't be surprised, I suppose, if I was there practicing my gymnastics routine in the middle of the night, that probably wouldn't be too far-fetched for what I was like. So she came in, found me. I couldn't get up. She couldn't really help me. She eventually got me to the next room. And what happened from then on in is I had some unusual experiences. I heard a voice telling me not to go to sleep. I'm not quite sure what that was about. Again, I was pretty much my own free will, so I went to sleep. I tried not to, but I fell asleep and I fell into a very big coma. So the next morning, my family couldn't wake me up. They called the doctor. The doctor then came in and rushed me off to hospital straight into emergency brain surgery. So it turns out that I had this malformation on my brain, just up on the right-hand side of my brain here. And it's quite likely that when I bumped my head on the bars that it just triggered something. So it's like having a brain aneurysm, except that the malformation had been there since birth. It wasn't something that had developed over time. It was something that I'd had there the whole time. Just bumping my head slightly might have just triggered it to then have an issue. My brain started to bleed. I had a brain hemorrhage. They put me on the operating table and they tried to go in and remove this malformation. It was at that point that something happened. I flatlined. They brought me back. And then they tried again to remove the malformation. They found out that there were a couple of little things in my brain that needed removing. It wasn't just the one. They tried again, flatlined again. They brought me back. And at that point, they said the surgery is too dangerous. We need to abort the surgery. So they got me stable. They shut down the surgery. They got me to a point where I guess bandaged me back up. They said, put her back in the ward. We'll get her recovered to a certain point and then we'll try again. Because at that stage, my body was just too weak. I was too frail to get through another attempt of trying to get to this issue in the brain. So they aborted the surgery, got me sorted, put me into critical care in the hospital, and I stayed in a coma for another few days there. What I remember is the voice telling me not to go to sleep. I then fell asleep. I was then in this beautiful black nothingness. It was a space where I didn't have any fear. I had confusion, but no fear. There was nothing there. It was like there was no noise, but there was no silence either. And there was no light, but there was no darkness. It was just a place of emptiness. It had nothing to it. And I had this experience with my father, and he was trying to connect with me, and he was asking me to connect with him. Through this experience, I was trying to find my body. I couldn't find my body. And then, I'm abbreviating it. I find it quite difficult to talk about this. As I'm there, I'm trying to connect. I feel this overwhelming feeling of responsibility that I have to connect in some way or things won't be okay. And so I'm giving my absolute all to connecting with my body, to connect with my father. And I just can't do it. I give everything I've got, to the point that it felt a little bit like suicide. It felt like I was, okay, this is it. And I counted down. I remember bracing myself, this is the end of life as I know it. I had no clue where I was. I had no clue what was going on, but I had this overwhelming desperation and feeling of responsibility, I suppose you could say. I give everything to it. I'm in a place of bright white light. It just boomed in front of me. And I'm in this light and it's amazing. And there are beings around me and they're clapping and they're cheering and they're celebrating me. And I'm thinking, wow, this is amazing. This is such a welcome party and I'm loving it and I don't know where I am. And so I'm still a little bit confused. Where am I? What's happening? But I'm loving this experience. And I notice that the beings around me, I don't know who they are and I can't connect with them. I don't recognize them. So I start to look at their faces and I'm looking around them all at their faces, trying to identify who they are. And I realize at that point, I'm not permitted to know who they are, but I'm stubborn. I'm the stubborn 12-year-old. So I'm like, well, I'm going to keep trying. So I keep trying to look at the faces. And at that point, it just all stopped. And I woke up in the critical care unit and I had tubes tied to me. I had everything happening. Things were beeping. There was all sorts of stuff going. And I looked at myself and I thought, everything is perfect. Everything is exactly as it needs to be. And I kind of get goosebumps even just saying that right now, because, I mean, you look at me, you walk in, and it was a shocking sight. There was, you know, I was paralyzed down one side of my body. I had this massive surgical scar where they had literally aborted the surgery. I couldn't move. I had tubes everywhere, and I'd just come out of this. It was around about a five-day coma. So on the outside, things didn't look good. And I was like, right, this is great. Let's get on with life. I am here and everything is perfect. So from that point, I had a whole new life. I mean, I couldn't walk. I couldn't do anything for myself. I spent a further couple of months in hospital where I was really rediscovering who I was. There was a lot of time there to think, a lot of time to process what is going on. And me being me, the way that I dealt with things was really just to push them internally, to push everything down. And I made a lot of commitments to myself in that hospital of, this will never define me. This isn't how I'm going to be. We didn't know whether I'd walk again. We didn't know whether I'd get the use of my arm back. We just didn't really know what was going to happen. So it was quite a journey going forward. It's one which was truly a gift to me. It's one where I feel like I got given this most amazing gift of life. And yeah, I mean, it's been fun ever since. It's been hard. There's been emotion. There's been some really, really dark times. But through it all, I go, but life is amazing. We should truly live this life.
No kidding.
So I guess that's where it started. Yeah.
Yeah. No kidding. Listen, bravo to you, by the way. I mean, there are so many things you've said there that we're going to kind of piecemeal and talk about. But I just want to acknowledge how at 12 years old, coming back from this coma, your very first thoughts are a redefinition of who you are.
I think
that's fascinating as a 12-year-old to think, oh, I recognize that I'm not able to walk. I'm not able to take care of myself, but this is not who I am, right? I think that that's fascinating and that you were able, you know, right out the gate, even before you probably started physical therapy, occupational therapy, you're thinking, this is not Kirsty Salisbury. I don't know if that was your last name at the time. I don't know if you got married.
No, it wasn't at the time.
Okay.
I think that potentially I came back with that. I mean, I was a fighter. I was a stubborn child. I was a fighter. I think that potentially I came back with, whether this was like a download that I got, I came back with stuff which I didn't go there with. I definitely think that I came back with something. When I first came back, I had the ability to be seeing different things happening in different places. So I could understand my parents and their emotions, and they were at home. I could understand them getting in the car. It was like I could see it. Now, the more I think about that, I'm like, did I see that, or did I just see it in my mind? I don't know, but I was very aware and connected to my family, as well as the current space where I was. And I remember thinking, how does this work? We're in different places. How can I be in different places at the same time? This did wear off after a few days. This attitude of everything is perfect exactly as it needs to be. I think that that was probably something I brought back from the other side. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
It wasn't all me.
Okay. No, I mean, still, I think it's fascinating. And it does speak to folks who go through a spiritually transformative experience or a near-death experience to have that shift in conscious perception. And, you know, having those thoughts kind of speaks to that. Now, if I can go back and ask you, when you were in this place of nothingness, it sounds like it's tough to describe, because at the beginning you said it was darkness. Then after you said there was no light, there was no dark, it was just nothingness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I appreciate that very much, by the way, that words are so limiting when you have such experiences and you want to translate it using words for everybody else to kind of
journey with you through that experience. But if you can, you weren't aware of having a physical body in this place.
Well, I was, because I was trying to connect with my body.
Okay.
My father was trying to say to me, can you be with me? Connect with me, hold my hand. And so I thought, well, this is all a bit weird. So I tried to connect with him, but I couldn't find my hand. And then I just was there. I don't know if I had a body. I don't know what was going on, but I couldn't connect. I couldn't find my body to connect with him. I couldn't find him either. It was like he was behind my right shoulder, very, very close to me, and yet a million galaxies away. It was like he was in me, part of me, and so separate. So there were all of these polarities happening all at the same time.
Okay.
So I was aware that I had a body, but I couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't aware of my physical body potentially on an operating table. Now, I don't know at what point of this experience any of this happened. I just know that it happened.
Okay.
So I wasn't aware of Earth. I was aware of me trying to connect with my father that was familiar, but I couldn't find him and I couldn't find my body.
Were there any other family members that were able to connect with you while you were in this place?
No, there was nothing. So the logical thing was, I thought, when I woke up, I thought, okay, so my father had been there. He'd been beside the bedside and he'd been squeezing my hand saying, okay, let me know you're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. My father was alive at the time, which makes the story very interesting because this isn't so common. We normally connect with past loved ones rather than living loved ones. So that's what I thought happened. Turns out that he was very distraught about the whole situation. Quite obviously, if you've got a child who's having emergency brain surgery, is pretty much on life support. So what happened from there is he stayed outside. He didn't come in and spend time with me. It was too emotional. I don't know what point it happened, whether it was while I was flatlined on the operating table. We don't know, in which case there would have been nobody there beside me, anyone, you know, stroking my hand saying, come back to me, it'll be okay. But it was this feeling of responsibility. And it was only my father, it was no one else. Then when I asked my father, did you come in and sit with me and did you have this conversation? And he said, no. Turns out that we'd had a family member who had done that, who had come in the later stages once I'd got a bit more stable and sat with me and told me all about a trip that they'd had. They told me about everything that was going on in their life. Now, they said, I don't remember any of that. They said, do you remember this person coming in? I said, no. What about this person? No. I only remember connecting with my father. And I think in hindsight, I've learned that's because he's probably on my spiritual team. There's probably some spiritual connection happening. Because when I look back on all the experiences we had in life, I go, oh, that would make sense, or that would make sense. And so he has now passed over. He's in a different place now. I believe that I've had contact with him since he died. A couple of days after his death, he came to connect with me. And that all sort of brings me to this belief that we're on part of the same team, that we've got something in common, whether he's now a guide or a physical helper, sorry, a spiritual helper or something like that. So I believe that that's why he came in this whole experience. Again, it's hard to make sense of it. I'm aware that I'm not making much sense, but I know what's happened. I know the experiences that I've had. And in a way, they kind of do make sense to me.
On Conversations with Roland. Everything makes sense to me. Okay.
Yes, somehow it does. I'm not quite sure how, yeah. But somehow it does.
Somehow yeah. It does. Especially when it's spiritual topics like this. Like, my mind is not going to be able to logically explain why it was your dad who showed up, even though he was, you know, not in a space to come and talk to you while you're in your coma. To me, it's fascinating. I like the uniqueness of your story in this sense. Now, let's move on. I want to ask you this. Growing up, were you raised in a family that was religious by any chance?
No. So I was raised in a family where we were not allowed to talk about religion. I'll say it was a very atheist environment. There was no acknowledgement of God. There was no acknowledgement of anything. I think both of my parents had been raised they were in the UK when they were growing up. They'd been raised in quite religious environments, I suppose, being forced to go to church, going to religious schools, things like that. And it didn't resonate with them at all, specifically my father, and he had shut the whole thing down. And we weren't allowed to talk about God in our family. There was no recognition of anything spiritual. There was nothing. So at 12 years old, people go, well, how did this change you? How did this change your spiritual outlook or anything like that? And I'm going, well, I didn't have one. I was 12 years old. I hadn't formed my view on the world. I didn't have an understanding about what life was about. And I hadn't been exposed to any kind of belief system whatsoever. So raised in a very atheist family. Yeah.
And that seemed to translate even with your STE or your near-death experience, because there was no, I guess, other than the bright white light that showed up after a while, which is kind of common with folks who go through NDEs. There's always this bright light, and then they may see a deity that they recognize based off of the religions that they kind of were raised in. But you didn't see any, you didn't even think that, oh, maybe this is God while you were there. It doesn't sound like.
No, I didn't think anything like that. I wasn't aware of God. I was, you know, had I seen Jesus or another figure, I don't know what I would have thought about that, because that wasn't something that was relevant to me in this earthly lifetime. I did always have a belief in God. I didn't know what to describe that as or how to put words into that. I always believed that there was something bigger than us. I always believed there was something like a higher power, something like that, more than what we have here. And so had I met God or Jesus or something like that, I probably would have actually just accepted that. So when I came back, the first thing I wanted to do was go to a church, because I associated what I had experienced with people in church believe in God. I need to go to a church to get closer, to get back to that experience. I need to reconnect with what I felt in that experience. So I didn't have a belief system. I didn't have any understanding of any religions, but I did have an overarching feeling that there was way more to life than what we could see. And I did believe in a supreme power being, whatever you want to call it.
Okay. Now, those are two staunch changes that you've alluded to that happened before and after your NDE. And we'll get to those in a second. I want to ask again how else you changed.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, but before we do, I wanted to talk about these beings you saw when you, I don't know if you walked through this light or if it kind of came at you. How did that happen?
I was just there. It was like it just changed and I was in this light and I could feel love. It was like love and happiness and, you know, I automatically go, yeah, there was music. It was like vibrations. It was waves of something. But I was just there. I was in this white light and there were these beings around me and they were celebrating. They were clapping and cheering. They were there. And it sounds really big-headed, but they were there for me. They were welcoming me. It wasn't about this environment, because I was kind of like showing up to a party, I suppose.
But it was for me.
Yeah, well, it was for me. I was very surprised. But I just was there. I wasn't questioning too much. I mean, I was trying to work out who these people were, because I was thinking, why are they so happy to see me? What is this all about? I got the feeling that beyond where I immediately was, beyond where these beings were with me, was that there was just such a vastness. There was millions and millions of, it's hard to even put a word on it, whether it was people, beings, entities, there was so much more beyond where we currently were. It was like there were, I want to say cities, and there was so much more beyond where we were, but I couldn't see it. I was in it. I was in this light, but I couldn't recognize, kind of like I couldn't recognize the beings. They were directly in front of me. They were around me. We weren't moving. We were just there. But I was aware that there was so much more beyond what we could initially see. Kind of like on the horizon, there was more.
So you
That's
could,
not making much sense, is it?
No, it is. It is making sense. So it's almost like you could sense their presence. You couldn't see them. But all of them were there celebrating your arrival to this place or welcoming you or something like that.
Yeah, it was like that. And there was probably, people have asked me how many were there. I'd say there was probably like 6 or 7 immediately. Like I'm talking within it's hard to say a distance, but I would say within like a meter or a half of me, I was here. They were around me, six or seven of them. And I don't know if they were behind me, but they were certainly in front of me.
Okay. Now, that strikes me. If anybody who's listening has read Michael Newton's Journey of Souls book, that kind of sounds like a soul family type setting there.
Yeah, well, that's what I've got to, is that they were probably my soul family. I didn't have anybody in my life at that stage. Remember, I was only 12 years old. Didn't have anybody who had died, or I'd had no massive loss in my life. So I don't know who they were. I don't know whether they were past loved ones from quite some time ago that maybe in this lifetime I wouldn't connect with, or I don't know if they were angels or if they were beings of some kind of, you know, someone to help me. I actually don't know, but they were there and they were there for me.
Okay. Well, that we've established that. Now, when you were in this place and you were seeing these beings and at least able to recognize and almost separate, right, and count that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's one being, there's another being. The way they were showing up, was that the same way you could perceive yourself? Or were you still not, like, aware of a defined entity that was Kirsty?
I was me. I don't know what I was, but I was there. They were like 3D silhouette figures. So they moved, they were there. They were kind of human shaped. I don't know. I would say it's so hard to describe. I'd say they're probably human shaped. They were just beings. It's not like they had big heads. They didn't have alien shaped heads or anything like that. I didn't feel any fear, no fear whatsoever. They were there. They were welcoming. I felt like they were humans.
Okay.
But there was no features.
Okay. I can't fault you for that. I appreciate you attempting to describe, you know, these unusual questions that I'm asking. You did mention something that sparked a question that came up while I was listening to your story. And that's the idea of you not experiencing any fear in this light. When you were in this space, we'll just call it where you were in this void, this dark space, and you were trying to connect with your body, you said you were trying so hard, it almost felt like you were committing suicide. I think those were your words.
And yeah.
If not, I apologize. But that strikes me as an interesting feeling to have, not in the physical body. Would you liken it to frustration of any kind, or how would you describe it as?
Probably desperation rather than frustration.
Okay.
I was desperately trying to connect. I had no fear. I had confusion because I couldn't understand why I couldn't connect with my body. I couldn't understand what was happening, but I got desperate, absolutely desperate that I had to connect. Now, I don't understand this because I don't know why I would need to connect. And, you know, what good can finding my father's hand and connecting with that make in the world? But it felt so, so incredibly important, like the future wouldn't be okay without it. It was a matter of life and death. And I can't explain that because it just, like, what could actually be that important? I don't know. But, yeah, more of a desperation. I was desperate to the point that I thought, okay, I've got to sacrifice myself for this. And that's the point that I got to.
Okay. That's really beautiful, right? To feel that, you know, the stake of the continuation of the reality that you were aware of at that point depended on you connecting with your body. I think that's fascinating. It almost shows how each of us is really an important piece of the puzzle, of this humongous puzzle, right? And then kind of the second reason why I was asking is because many times when we think of the other side or heaven, we think it's this place that is void of any feelings other than like love and everything being perfect. And so for you to have that desperation type feeling is almost like, oh, can you be desperate and be like fully in love? Or can you separate being fearful from love? Like, can you only have that? That's why I don't know if me saying that makes sense, but that's why I was asking, like, how can you feel something that you usually associate with only available here on the planet to be on the other side?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. And I think it possibly comes back to those feelings of the polarities of everything was great, everything's terrible. You know, there was no light, but there was no darkness. Can we have these mixed emotions at the same time? And I think being in that void area where there was nothing, I felt like that was a very different place to being in that light, being in the beautiful white with the beings. That was a very different place. I feel like potentially we could experience different feelings and emotions in those two different places.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
I don't know.
No, that's so cool. It's so neat because it's a unique way of going through an NDE that I've not come across yet with the countless people I've spoken to who have had similar experiences. All right. So as far as the way you changed, man, I love this. You come back with this knowingness that everything's perfect and you have the courage to start defining yourself as I am not this limited person. And then the other thing you said I thought was interesting is the desire to start going to church.
It seemed like the most logical thing to do. And remember, I'd grown up in a family. I'd never been to church before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'd never been to even a funeral. I'd never been to a funeral at that stage. I'd been so protected by anything like that. And I had this experience and I went, oh, that must have been God. I want to go back to heaven. You know, white light heaven. And the only exposure that I'd had to anything had probably been Bible in schools in my school time at primary school. So we're talking when I'm 8, 9, 10 years old, I'm hearing Bible stories and I'm learning about heaven and hell. And I'm going, well, that was white light. That must be heaven. The people in my Sunday school, well, my Bible in schools people talked about that. They went to church. And you can see I put all these dots together. I just wanted to go to church. So I went along to church and I remember leaving because it was all just a bit crazy. And I went down into the car park. And I remember standing in the car park and looking into the sky and just going, I don't know about any of this, God, but I know that I'm here and I will give you my life and I will do whatever it is you want me to do. Because I came back with this overwhelming sense of purpose, overwhelming sense of I've got something to do, because if I didn't, I would have died. I would have stayed there. Why did I not die? Because it was so grim. I've come back for some reason. So I remember standing there in the car park going, okay, whatever reason it is, let's do this. I've got what it takes. I've got you talking to God. You know, I'll do whatever you want. You're just going to have to help me out. And I remember standing in the car park just absolutely and like 100% committed that whatever life had for me, I was going to do it.
How old were you when this happened? When you make that commitment?
I'd had the AVM 3 weeks after my 12th birthday. I then had a couple of months of quite intensive hospital time and some physical rehab. I had learnt how to walk again to the degree that I could get out and about for short periods of time. And this was like the first time I'd been out properly, left the house. And I remember my mother wasn't too keen on me going, especially not to a church, but she wasn't too keen on me going because she was still very afraid that I wasn't ready yet, that I didn't have the strength or the energy or what if something happened. And so I remember going, it'll be okay, it'll be okay. And I had my best friend with me as well. We went together and I'd convinced everybody I'd be okay. And I kind of knew that I'd be fine. I knew that everything was going to be fine going forward, that there'll be some hard parts, but it was going to be fine. And so it's probably, gosh, it would have been nearly a year later by this stage, probably 10 months later. Okay. When I went to this church. So I'd had a lot of time to think about things. I'd had a lot of rehab. We hadn't fixed the problem because, remember, they'd aborted the surgery. I still had the issue in my head. So I was kind of what they described as a walking time bomb, that it could all blow at any time. So that gave me a real sense of life is so fragile. At any point, I could die. Quite a lot to deal with, you know, at that stage in life.
Yeah, as a 12-year-old,
Yeah, I think I learned a lot. And also as a kid, that was never still. I had to stay very, very still. I couldn't do anything to raise my heartbeat. I couldn't do anything to raise my blood pressure, anything like that, because that would increase the blood flow. And obviously the blood flow is going to go up past this part, which has had surgery in the brain. So I was told to live a very calm, sedate life. I had to sit on the couch and kind of do nothing. So this was a very big time to go out of the house. And I remember I went out the house and I went along to this youth group at this church. And I was so excited to be leaving the house, but so excited to be going somewhere where they believed in heaven, they believed in God. Oh, so that's kind of how that started, yeah.
Yeah. Now, do you have siblings?
I have a brother, yeah, an older brother.
Okay. How was his, response or reaction to these experiences that you were going through?
It's quite a hard one because I think as a family, we all kind of just pushed it inside. We all sort of pretended that everything was fine and to carry on with it. I know that it was probably extremely difficult on my brother. He got shipped out to different people. I remember when it happened, I remember asking my mother when it happened, where was my brother? What happened to him? He'd gone off and stayed for a few nights at a friend's house. And then obviously there was a time there where my family were coming into the hospital every day. There was a lot for him. He was in high school at this stage. A lot for him as he's, growing up and going through some crucial years in his life as well. Having to be put as a lower priority for a time. And that must have been extremely difficult for him. We've talked about it a little bit, but as a family, we kind of just pushed everything down. And that's exactly what I did. I didn't talk about my story for 27 years because I'd pushed it so deep and it was so hard to deal with. I'd got on with life. I was the fighter. I just got on with life and I did life and I carried on and I got back up on my feet and I did what I needed to do. But I pushed all the emotions in and I carry around quite a few emotions because I felt like I was a bit of a burden to the family. I felt like I was hard work. There was stuff that was going on that I created issues. So there was a whole lot of emotional stuff that came out of this. And I just buried that nice and deep. And so my family did as well. We all kind of had our way of coping with it, which was to not really talk about it.
Yeah.
Even though it was such an obvious thing. I mean, how do you go through this? I couldn't walk. I needed help with everything. I wasn't going to school. And we just kind of carried on as normal.
I wonder if your attitude had something to do with it. Because in hearing the way you came out of the coma, you sounded very optimistic. And I would imagine that's how you spoke with your family. And so they may have just thought, well, if she's going to be this way, let's follow her down that path. But then the other thing was just the fact that, your family wasn't... Like you said, they weren't entirely religious. So it would have made it difficult for you to be able to discuss this sort of otherworldly spiritual aspects with them as well. So you had kind of those two dynamics at play.
Ah, yeah, I didn't talk about it at all. I didn't, I asked my father, were you there squeezing my hand? Were you there trying to communicate with me? When he said no, that's where I thought, okay, I didn't know what had happened. I couldn't put it together. I wondered whether I'd gone a bit crazy. I just had brain surgery. Maybe, I've got a little brain injury there. I wondered whether actually I was just a bit off balance and I was a little bit scared to tell anyone anything. I certainly wasn't going to tell my family that I think I've been to heaven because that wasn't a discussion that we had. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And, we want to touch on regrets here with this conversation. And when I listen to your story, there are many opportunities for you to look back and almost feel like maybe I would have regretted, or I regret the fact that I didn't speak about it earlier, or I regret the fact that my family did not allow us to go to church because it would have made sense, it will have helped me make sense of these experiences. I regret the fact that we didn't share experiences with my family. We weren't open like that, right? All those regrets. But As far as before we do, I'm always saying, but before we do, I love it.
Yeah, I love it too.
One thing I just wanted to say, I certainly relate to someone going through such an experience and feeling like they were going crazy. I mean, you and I were just part of the IANS conference and you were an amazing, panel host and moderator for our discussion group. But during that conversation, I also shared how I felt when I started meditating and having these interesting experiences because of the foundation that I had. I really felt like not only was I going crazy, I was possessed by something that was not unconditionally yeah. loving, right? It really scares you. And so just to say I can relate to feeling out of sorts, like not the normal person when you're going through such experiences. So if we can pivot just real quick and answer the question, this is where everything started. It's like how the healing came back in the left side of your body.
It just started to come back. So when I first woke up, they didn't know what was going to happen. So I don't know whether it's an insurance thing or whether they actually just don't want to get your hopes up or they don't want to be liable for anything. But they were saying, look, we just don't know whether she's ever going to walk again. We don't know if she'll get the regain the movement or the feeling in her left side. At this stage, I was, you know, there was nothing going on, completely paralyzed. I remember I hadn't registered that I was paralyzed. I registered that I needed help with things and that I couldn't feel my left side. But I remember at one point I was sitting, and this is by the time I'd been through, so I was in critical care, I got moved to intensive care, then I got moved onto the ward. So this is the time when I'm now in the ward. And I remember looking at my arm and just going, oh, they're telling me I'm paralyzed and it's not going to work. But surely if I put something in my hand, I can still hold it. And all I had around me was a watch that they'd put on the table that was over my bed. I had a watch and maybe a pen or something. And I remember picking up the watch and going, well, if I pick up my left hand and if I put the watch in the left hand, then I'll be able to hold it. And I thought, okay, I can't raise my arm because I couldn't move it at all. I can't raise my arm up, but surely if I do that part for my arm, hold it up and then put something in it, then it will be okay from then onwards. And I remember thinking they've got it all wrong. So I put the watch in my hand and I was holding my arm like this. I let go and it just crashed onto the table. And that was one of the first times that I really registered that there was nothing happening with my left side. And I started to think, oh, maybe they're right. Maybe I'm not going to get this back. Maybe I'm not going to be able to walk again. But I felt like everything was okay. And if that was how my future was going to be, that's how it was going to be. And that was going to be okay. We were going to get around it. We were going to make it work. And then my father used to come in and he used to come in and sit in one of the chairs next to me. Now, I had a really unusual relationship with my father. And like I say, if I look back on my lifetime, I can see how he connects with me on a spiritual level, even though we didn't talk about God, we didn't talk about anything spiritual in our physical lifetime together. It's really unusual. So he would come and he'd sit in this chair and every day he'd talk to me about different things. And this was shortly after the watch incident when I'd picked up the arm and dropped it. And I thought, I know what I'm going to do. Every time he comes in, I'm going to be able to show him something new I can do. And that might have been that I might have been able, we had these toothbrushes, which were like sticks with little sponges on them. I might have been able to brush my teeth. So not even using my left side, but just getting the thing around my gum because my mouth was drooping and I was dribbling and, you know, my whole face was hanging. So maybe that would be something little I could show him. And then at the next time it was maybe there's something else I could show him. And I started this goal of every time my father came in, I'd be able to show him one new thing because I was a fighter. I was going to do this. I was going to get through this and I was going to make my father proud of me because I felt like a burden. So I was finding things that would make him be proud of me and that could be, you know, I wasn't a total failure in how he was perceiving things. So I was reading a lot into this. And as I'm saying this, I'm going, man, I really carried quite a lot there. But I made this decision to show him something new every day. And that turned into, at one point, I think it was like my little finger, I wiggled it and got a little movement out of it, my left one. And then the next day I could move a couple of fingers, not maybe the next day, but a few days later. And every day he came in, I was like, look, I can do this, or I've done this, or I've had this experience with one of the therapists or the physios or someone. And it was really that motivation to show my father that I could do something, that I was progressing and getting better, that really aided my recovery. And once the movement started to come very, very slowly, I'm talking like twitching a toe or a finger, then it's almost like it started to increase. The more I focused on it, the faster it got. And that was really, really cool. So then I actually learned how to do things. And then one day he came in and I was sitting in his chair rather than in the bed. And I remember this so clearly. And it was such a matter of, I'll show you, I can do whatever I want, you know, like real attitude stuff. And then it was learning how to go to the bathroom, how to go on the walker, different things. They wanted to put me in a wheelchair when I first left the hospital. And I was okay to get in the wheelchair to go down to the car, but they wanted us to take the wheelchair home and for me to use the wheelchair. And I was just adamant that I didn't want to be seen in a wheelchair. I look back and I go, what the heck? What was that about? I was really stubborn. I really was. So I refused a wheelchair. And then that motivated me, once I could shuffle around and take a few steps, to learn how to take more steps, because I didn't want to use a wheelchair when I went out. I didn't want to go to school when I eventually got back to school. The first few times I had to go in a wheelchair. I didn't want all the kids looking at me and laughing at me. So I was so motivated to learn how to stand up for longer periods of time. I was having daily physio, I was having daily occupational therapy, all of these things. And I threw myself into it because I just wanted to recover. I didn't want to be that freaky kid. And so that's kind of where it happened. Where we've got to today, I'm not fully recovered. I have most of the mobility. My left side is constantly numb. I don't know if you can see in the video. I don't use this hand. It works. It's very hard for me to open it. I don't know if you can see that.
I can see that, yeah.
I don't use it. I avoid using this hand, and it curls, as you can see. My comfy spot's like that. And so, yes, it works. It's completely numb. I don't have fine... I can kind of,
wow, that's kind of do
it, you know. So my fine motor movements are not there by any means, but I can get in the gym. I can do CrossFit of all things, which blows my mind. I mean, I do it very badly with the lightest weights, but I can do it because that's not the fine motor movements. I'm one of the weakest people that you'll see, but I'm okay with that. And you know, I work with trainers and all sorts of stuff. I've done constant physical therapy my entire life since. So to the point that even now I do it. I consider my gym sessions as therapy rather than
like working out. Man, please don't sell yourself short. I mean, again, it's that English language thing. You say you're weak physically, okay, cool, but mentally you're very strong. I mean, you keep using the word stubborn, but it comes up to me as like, that's really strong. And it also, before I ask this, what was your dad's reaction when he came in and saw you kind of have this new skill that you could show him?
Oh, he was really proud of me. And that meant the world to me. I wanted to have favor in his eyes, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. And that's what I was asking, because you did have that positive reinforcement. It wasn't a case where your dad was, you know, kind of dismissive or not supportive.
Oh, no, no.
Yeah.
He was engaged. He was an amazing man, but it was a very difficult situation. I can understand in hindsight. Mm-hmm. And he didn't, you know, I picked up these things, these feelings of like I was a problem. I picked that up and I carried that. And I see that we do this in our lives. All of us do this.
Yeah.
But no, he was great. Didn't mean we got on so well, but you know.
Yeah. Hey. If someone's part of your soul group and you get on like super well, my attitude towards that is maybe they're not helping you grow. Like they should challenge you. That's really how you grow, right? Either whether purposefully or if they're even oblivious to it, I think it's still beneficial. Mm-hmm. I mean, our closest relationships, they usually challenge us the most because of those agreements.
So much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, with just being this really strong-minded person and soul, I mean, you talked about on the other side, you weren't supposed to find out who those beings were. And you're like, I want to find out who this being. beings are. I think it makes sense for you to talk to us about regret. Because many times regret is a mind-related, you know, experience or feeling. And like I said, I look back at your life and there are so many moments where even today, you can look back and regret that that's how it went. Why did this happen to me? But how have you been able to, you know, besides the fact that you're very strong-minded, work with regret to help you define who you are and be that person that you're defining?
Yeah, I mean, I think you almost summed it up there. You said, why did this happen to me? And look, I had dark days. I remember lying in the hospital bed and just so angry with the world, and I was crying my eyes out. I was going, why has this happened to me? Why me? What did I do to deserve this? And I remember after some time, there was this baby who was over opposite me, and the baby had all these problems. And I went, oh, why did this happen to me? Rather than why did this happen to me, why did this happen? Do you see how I've reframed the same words?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this baby had an impact on me, and I could go down that full story, but I'm aware of timing. I want to, I had a lot of time to think about things. So I started to go, why did this happen? Why did I have that experience? Why do I feel like life is good? And start to reframe what are the opportunities? Because remember, I'd put myself in a place of looking for opportunity every single day because I wanted to impress my father when he came in, that I pursued some new opportunity, that I'd created something for myself, that I'd done something positive. So this started to really drive me. And I look back and I go, maybe that was part of that soul contract that we had together, that he would put this in me or help me nurture this thing that had been put in me. And I think regret is such a major thing. Everybody can relate to regret. But actually, I regret nothing. I think regret is a bit of a waste. I think regret is where we look at situations, things that have happened, and we've got an emotional connection. We can't let go. We feel like it's outside of our control. We feel like we're carrying around the weight of something that happened. And I mean, that does no good for anyone. Regret gets in the way of us making positive decisions, of us moving forward, of us living this life to the full. And that's one thing that I said to myself in the hospital bed was, I'm going to squeeze the juice out of this life. If I've come back, if I'm alive and I didn't die, I'm here to live and I'm going to squeeze the juice out of this life. But if we start to regret, we can't live that way. And so I've thought a lot about all these different situations when things got really tough. Now, trust me, I've not got this right the whole way. There have been some epic breakdowns in life as this process has taken place. It has got really emotional, really ugly at times. So it's not smooth sailing. But what I've tried to do is to reframe when I'm feeling low, when things are falling apart around me, how do I reframe this into a positive perspective? Or it's almost like reverse engineering life. So what am I going to regret later? In the current moments, will I regret this in a year's time or in 5 years' time? Will I regret this when my child grows up thinking that this is normal behavior because this is how I acted? Will I regret the way that I held my relationships? Will I regret the things that I do? And it can cause us to get into a place where we can never quite move on because we're constantly worried about how we're acting, and it's like we're weighing up all of our decisions all the time, and they can get very, very heavy. Am I going to regret this later? That can get quite heavy. But if we can actually acknowledge the things that we think will be good and will be not good, then we can start to understand how regret works. We can start to understand how we respond or react to situations, the things that maybe we do have some regret. So it's not saying that I've never had regret. There's definitely times where I've had it, but it's understanding what we can do with that regret. So how do we go back and eliminate it? How do we go back and fix it so it's no longer having its hold on us or festering in our life or affecting the relationships? You know, if we have a relationship with someone and there's something there and we're regretting something and it's holding us back, maybe it's time to actually go have a conversation about that regret. Maybe it's time to fix the issue. And I think often regret is about a conversation, quite often with ourselves. It's not necessarily a conversation with someone else, but we can get angry at ourselves. We hold on, I should have known better, I shouldn't have done that, especially if there's consequences that go forward. If we had an action that we did and then there was a consequence, someone got hurt or something happened out of that action, it can be very hard for us to let go and go, I was so silly, I shouldn't have done that. But if we process it and have a conversation at a deeper level with ourselves, often we can find the way to let go of the regret.
Yeah.
Is that making sense?
It is. You're seeing so many things. I mean, the whole idea of having that conversation with yourself is huge. If you can get to a place with yourself in dealing with an experience that you kind of regret, where you no longer regret it, that's a huge part of moving forward. To me, it sounds like, oh, I forgave myself and I'll do better next time. Another thing that you've said that I really liked is that you can reduce the amount of regret that you experience in your life by reframing and asking the question before you take an action, if you're going to regret this in the future, right? Am I going to regret doing this? Or, and I love this one, am I going to regret not doing this, right? And that kind of puts you in a place to move forward to chase whatever dreams is it that you have.
And
one of them was mine as well, you know, deciding to start a podcast. After I had the awakening and I was talking to people and we were having amazing conversations like this, and I thought, oh, it would be nice to share with somebody. I mean, and just the idea of feeling, or just the idea of, you know, feeling like it would be nice to share this with somebody was enough for me to say, well, if I don't do this, will I regret not starting a podcast? I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
But then you realize everything exists for you to start up. I didn't have to make computers. Yeah. I didn't have to make this. It was all there. But
yeah,
there would have been a lot more regret for me if I didn't start the podcast. I really love the idea of talking to yourself, because that's huge with forgiveness and realizing it's probably impossible to live a life without regret. And you allude to this. It's really how you respond to it when you recognize it and then how you choose that forward.
Afterwards. Recognizing it's a huge part, because we need to reassess every now and then. We might not have regret now, but in a month's time, we might have something that's happened in that month and we've got the regret then. So let's deal with that, rather than what I would normally do as a younger person is just to push it away and pretend it didn't happen, which seems to be the way that people deal with it, because regret's an uncomfortable feeling. But it's reassessing on a regular basis. What do I regret? Do I have any things I wish I'd done differently? And then working through on different layers, different levels, going deeper. How do I address this regret? But I love what you talk about with the podcast as well, because I put out a survey, gosh, it was quite a few years ago now, actually, to people. It was literally just a quick question. Do you think in life we regret most the things we didn't do or the things we did do? And without a doubt, I can't remember the stats off the top of my head now, without a doubt, there was more people said, I think we regret the things we didn't do. So life is kind of like this adventure playground. I look at life and I go, man, that's one giant playground, and we could go over here and try this. So if you want to try podcasting, go over and have a go. It doesn't matter whether we get it wrong, but let's have a go. Or you want to try some type of cooking, like Thai cooking, go over here. If you want to master that, have a little play. Oh, you want to go over and try writing a book? Let's write a book. And you want to try this, and you want to learn how to swim, and you want to be an athlete, or you want, you know, life is one big playground. And I think we're here for a very physical experience. We are spiritual beings. And so it's not about going to try every possible physical experience out there. We don't need to go skydiving. We don't need to go and risk our life and do all these multi-amazing, dangerous sports. But if you feel called to do that, or if you feel like that lights something up in you, go and do it. So regret, a lot of people said that they think we will regret the things we don't do rather than the things that we do. And I think with the things that we do and then we regret it later, then we nut out, why did I regret doing that? Maybe it was scary and you had to put your neck on the line for something. Maybe it put you publicly in front of someone like you doing your podcast. Why do I regret the thing that I did? And then reframing it, because I don't know how, I think it's easier to reframe the things we did that didn't go well rather than the things that we didn't do that didn't go well.
Yeah.
So I see life as a great big playground, opportunities everywhere. If we pursue things, if we go and have experiences and try things that don't go well, we regret them, then we can reframe that and potentially try again. I think in everything there's a learning opportunity. So when things go really bad in life, so what? It's a learning opportunity. And I don't think that's a bad thing to have a learning opportunity. I think for so long we've pursued positive experiences, and of course we have. But if we pursue some of the things in life which are a little bit harder, I think that's where the value is. I think that's where our growth happens. That's where the exciting things happen, like you to set up your podcast. I know as well, for when I set up my own podcast, It's a little bit scary, especially at the beginning. You're thinking, I'm going public with this, even though you know it's only your mother and maybe mother's neighbor that are tuning in to listen. You're still like, I'm in a public space. This is scary. But you know what? A couple of years down the line, when you're quite familiar with it, I'm going to say it's still quite scary. I still get butterflies when I go on my own podcast. I'm still a little bit nervous to be public, but it's more familiar. And the regret that I would have felt from not doing that, or the regret you would feel from not doing your podcast, is going to be so much bigger than the learning opportunities and pursuing the harder options in life. Is that making sense about pursuing the harder things?
Yes, it is. And one of the things you spoke about with, or that comes with pursuing the harder things in life, is the value of regret, I think, which is that it's an opportunity to learn, to expand your consciousness. And to grow. There, and you talked about failing, and you can also reframe failing as a learning of how not to do something, or of a better way to do something, right? And I find that as one of the biggest values of regret. And knowing that we live on planet Earth, and listening to the way you talk, it's like, okay, she's definitely had, you know, a spiritually transformative experience. This place provides us the opportunity to experiment, to test. And every time we do experiment, we make things our own. So there is no other person who is podcasting like Roland is. There's no other person who is podcasting like Kirsty is. And that makes, you know, you bringing a new flair to podcasting, that somebody who may not even have an interest in podcast is getting sort of a learning through osmosis by maybe listening to my podcast and then listening to yours and saying, okay, that's one way to podcast. That's another way to podcast. Now, I may never, ever have the desire to podcast, but look at what these people are showing me. Different ways to podcast. And I think that's beautiful.
And totally. I love it.
Yeah.
I think we are spiritual beings. So I've talked a lot about the physical experience today. One thing I will say is we do need to go and sit and ground and be still. And just like in that car park, and I looked up and I went, God, what are we doing? You know, I'll do anything. You just leave me. I still do the same thing very regularly. I go and I sit. I've got my father's chair, which is just the most beautiful thing to me, my one object that I just love. And I'll go and sit there and I'll go, okay, God, call it God, source, higher self, whatever your word is that you connect with. What are we doing? How does this work? Am I aligned? I think we need to align. We need to take time to be still and to check in. I think we can live life at a very fast pace. This is very, very easy to do, especially in today's age. But it's about taking time to connect and make sure that we're aligned with our purpose and our path for this lifetime. So it's a very spiritual focus within a physical experience.
I like that.
Yeah. And I think that's where we can have the most fun. Like, if you want to go and have the most fun lifetime you can possibly have, you're going to fly by the seat of your pants. It's going to be fun. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be terrifying, but it's connecting in with that spiritual side and then pursuing all the things that scare you. And if you feel directed, go and do those things, because it's scary, but man, it's a blast.
Of course.
And I think that's the way we can have the most fun and get the most out of this lifetime.
Oh, yeah. I could not agree more. And I just want to throw that out, disclaimer. What you described there sounds a lot like meditation. And my audience knows I love meditation, and we didn't even talk about it, but I
meditation's great.
It's so awesome, and it's free.
Yeah.
And you have everything you need to do it. Just your physical body, the ability to breathe and to think. Yeah.
Ah. The spiritual experience is so exciting. People think it's boring. It's so exciting. And yeah, we've got to meditate. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I love it. Totally. We should have another conversation where we talk about meditating. We're right at the end here. Your story's fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing. I will have links for ways people can connect with you, KirstySalisbury.com. That will be in the notes section of this podcast, as well as below this video if you're watching it on YouTube. And from there, you can, you know, find out what Kirsty is up to. You can get her books, A Life by Design, Let's Talk Life Design. Those are two books that she has available now that you can buy. I think think it's also on Amazon. You can pick that up.
Yep, they're on Amazon. I've also got this, my latest book, this one here, which is called Dying Well. And this is an approachable guide to embracing death. So that's a whole conversation we didn't even get to, was actually embracing death. But
sounds like you're going to be back.
I'd love to. I talk a lot about that sort of thing on the podcast, which is Let's Talk Near Death. And yeah, it's all about the spiritual experience in this physical realm.
Yeah. Death is fascinating. I mean, it's like the ultimate fear for many of us who have not had an ST or NDE. You ask, what's your number one fear? It's probably, you know, dying. And so we kind of live a life of protecting ourselves, right? Kind of survival. And that really dictates a lot of our behavior too. And so it would be great for you to come back and we can have that conversation about, you know, getting comfortable with the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I could talk about that all day.
Of course. Oh, you're so great. Thank you so much. And by the way, please tell everybody where you're talking to me from, because I think it's fascinating that they should know.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you might have heard from the accent. I am currently in Auckland in New Zealand. So I was raised in, well, born and bred here in New Zealand. Traveled a lot of my time. I'm come from a very British family. So we arrived in New Zealand right before I was born. And yeah, the world's an exciting place. I've traveled a lot. Look forward to coming out to where you are sometime, Roland.
I would love to have you. Actually, I would love to take you to Cameroon in West Africa. Then maybe I'll come visit you in New Zealand.
That's on my dream, to go to Africa, West Africa.
Yeah.
Totally. No, yeah.
We'll make the trip.
When the borders open.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
I'd love that.
Oh, well, thank you so much for getting up early and recording this conversation with me. Guys, like I said, I'll have links to her website in the notes section of this podcast. You know how to connect with me, roland@chenjiang.com. And as always, I invite you to create an amazing day. Thank you, Kirsty.
Thank you.